coming up in the My Ag Life Daily News Report. We continue our focus on water as the State Water Resources Control Board wraps up day two of its April meeting. Hear comments from the public workshop on phase one of the Salton Sea Plan. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson. I will also have today's news brief. But first, it's Tech Thursday, and that means Taylor's here with this week's tech feature.
Hi, welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today is Tech Thursday, a new bi-weekly segment where we talk about technological advances in ag. Our guest today is Steve Boer, founder and chairman of Smart Guided Systems, LLC, and we'll be discussing a new intelligent spray control system. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Steve, my first question for you here. You recently collaborated with Heiping Zhu and USDA ARS to develop a retrofit kit that turns standard sprayers into intelligent sprayers. How and why was this technology developed?
So if you look at, and we actually have a presentation where it shows a sprayer that was 20 years old, even 30 years old, and you look at a sprayer that's being sold today, and it's literally the exact same sprayer. So the technology has not changed in 20 or 25, 30 years. And, luckily Dr. Zhu saw a real opportunity to save chemicals, better coverage, less runoff, and spent a lot of time and U.S. taxpayer dollars on developing the intelligent spray control system. And when we saw that technology for the first time in Wooster, Ohio, as owner of the business, I said, guys, our focus is going to be on this system because when you can do a positive environmental impact and you can reduce the amount of chemicals spent and have a return on investment and usually less than a year for most crops, in the crop reporting that we're able to do, I saw that really as the future of the company. So everything that we had, prior developed, it was focused on commercializing the system that Dr. Zhu and his team did with the USDA.
And is this the first collaboration of its sort, trying to find like a new technology for these sprayers? Why hasn't this technology seen this type of advancement in the time it's been around?
One thing Dr. Zhu pointed out, and I found to be true as we, commercialize the system, but there's been a lot of universities, a lot of different companies trying to do what Dr. Zhu has done. And I think, the reason why that he was able to do that was because that was his sole focus. He had a lot of focus on not only the spraying technology, but also on the electronic technology that was able to do that. So that was a big advantage that we had as a head start and why there's not competitors yet. And, we're very thankful that we were able to get a exclusive technology transfer agreement for this technology with the USDA.
Okay. Steve, my next question for you here. What are the features and benefits of this intelligent spray system?
So one thing we do is, every spray nozzle, if you look at AirBlast sprayers, there's usually at least 12 or 14 nozzles per side. And every nozzle has a particular spray zone that it targets on the plant or tree. And what this technology does is it looks at every zone of a spray nozzle and slices that at 120,000 points per second. And it determines how much density per spray zone. So every spray zone becomes a variable rate independent sprayer, basically. An example would be if you have 300,000 points of density in nozzle 3, but 400,000 points of density in nozzle 4, we'll pulse that nozzle at 10 times per second, and we're able to put more material on nozzle 4 at 400,000 points of density than we are at the nozzle 3 at 300,000 points of density. So really incredible way to spray, and also not just the savings, but the coverage and less runoff because of the pulsing.
Yeah, it sounds like growers, depending on what they're growing, have a lot of customized customizable options for their sprayer in terms of those nozzles.
Exactly. So part of our setup is you put in your spray rate, you put in your pressure, put your nozzle size, and you can have different nozzles on your sprayer, and our system will account for that. So if you want to put a, you know, more material on top versus less on the bottom, you can adjust that spray rate per nozzle. And then based on density, it, you know, puts more or less, also based on density and the nozzle itself.
Okay. Yeah, that's really useful. Steve, my next question for you here. What was the overall goal of making the system a retrofit kit as opposed to an entirely new sprayer system?
You know, research has been done, and the average life of a sprayer in the U.S. is 25 years old. And, it you know, it seems hard to believe because, you know, at least 30% of the input cost of permanent crop, high value permanent crop, is chemicals. And, you know, I'm a little surprised that growers would use such an old machine to put on the chemicals that aren't calibrated typically. But one thing we wanted to do is not make it where you had to go buy a new sprayer. So, we can adapt that sprayer. We can calibrate that sprayer that's old, and really make it operate as a newer sprayer. And we found that as a key piece to get out to the marketplace and get growers adapting to the technology.
Do you think growers might have been reluctant to, you know, buy a new sprayer, switch technology due to a cost factor? Or was it maybe like a, if it's not broke, don't fix it type of situation?
I think a lot of it is, these growers have not had technology, so they're very reluctant to adapt technology. I think it'd be a really tough sell to say, we've got a great technology, but you have to buy a new sprayer and the technology, which really doubles the price of adapting, the technology to the farm or the grower. So, to me, it was a key thing that we could adapt to sprayers. And that came with challenges. You know, there's 256 different models and brands of sprayers just in the U.S. And every kit's a little bit different. But, we found a way to commonize the components, and then it's kind of like an erector set. So you can adapt it to just about any sprayer fairly easy overall.
Okay. Like you said previously, pesticide applications take up a huge percentage of a grower's budget. You know, how much will this retrofit kit cost? And are there particular sprayers that it does or doesn't work on maybe?
It'll adapt to any brand or model. Some are easier than others. If it's a standard air blast sprayer and not electrostatic, it's definitely easier. But our standard kit retails with, we have an air system filtration that keeps the LiDAR lens clean, which is critical, and that's part of the standard kit now. But, it's around $30,000. But if you look at cost per acre and number of acres growers, spray per sprayer, typically they can get a return on investment in less than 6 months or a year at the very most in most cases.
Yeah, that is a really fast timeline, actually. Steve, my last question for you here. When will the retrofit kit be commercially available, and how can growers purchase it?
It's actually available now. We've had them on the market now for, 2 years in May is when we first installed our first system. And since then, we've got about, I don't really want to say the number of kits, but almost a three-digit number of kits in the field. And we're shipping them all over the world currently, India, South America, Australia, New Zealand, as well as Canada. And back in early December, we signed a worldwide agreement with John Deere now to distribute those systems to their dealers in U.S., Canada, and Australia. So a lot of the dealers in the key market areas of air blast sprayers now are becoming dealers, and we're seeing a lot of adoption now through the dealer network with their customers.
with the John Deere deal is that like the retrofit kit is coming attached to one of their machine sprayers, or is it kind of going being sold separately under their brand?
Harder to believe, but they don't sell AirBlast sprayers. So that to me is also a benefit, because if the dealer sells three different brands of sprayers, he can adapt and sell that system on three different sprayers as a new sprayer, or go out in the field and retro with his customers. So, I think that's been a real benefit that they're not in that market right now, and the dealer can adapt it to any brand or model. And sometimes, we just had a dealer in California where the grower wanted new sprayers and our system. So it's a real benefit for the dealer as well.
That's great. Yeah, it sounds like since its implementation into the industry that people are starting to catch on to it.
Yeah, and the John Deere arrangement that we have, to me, it gives a stamp of approval. First we were a small company in Indiana. We have no customers here. There's just not a lot of permanent crops here. And having the John Deere stamp of approval really put us on the map of, okay, when they stamp it, it's approved, and it's a lot easier sale to growers and the dealers because of that. So we're very thankful for the John Deere agreement.
Definitely. Well, Steve, that was some great information on this new intelligence spray control system. Really great work on that. It sounds like more and more growers are going to be looking into this type of technology as time goes on, as things, start to get more automated. So really interesting stuff. And we appreciate you coming on today.
I appreciate it. Yeah. And obviously, if there's any questions that your listeners might have, they can reach out or go to smartapply.com. And one thing I didn't really talk about at all is, the chemical savings are great, but the data that we collect as we spray is outstanding. So we can inventory trees by size and density and collect all that electronic data now too.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Thanks, Taylor. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
AgriMajor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgriMajor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpak R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgriMajor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpak 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today. This week, 13 animal welfare and environmental groups urged federal agencies to maintain regulatory authority over genetically engineered food animals within the Food and Drug Administration. The request is in response to the Trump-era proposal to move the regulatory authority to the Department of Agriculture. Specifically, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service would oversee regulatory authority over genetically engineered animals. In letters to the FDA and USDA, the group claims, quote, FDA possesses the scientific and administrative capacities to regulate these animals better than USDA. The groups contend, quote, genetically engineered animals are a significant new threat to our food systems. That again from those animal rights groups. The 13 groups signing the letters to the Biden administration include the Center for Food Safety, the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Friends of the Earth, and National Family Farm Coalition, among others. As essential workers, farmers, and ranchers need quick access to the COVID-19 vaccine to ensure a stable food supply chain, Michael Klimitz shares how the American Farm Bureau Federation is helping promote vaccine acceptance.
The American Farm Bureau Federation is helping farmers and ranchers and farm workers get the COVID-19 vaccine. AFBF Congressional Relations Director Allison Crittenden says they are doing so through the COVID-19 community corps.
So it's a group of organizations organized by the White House that are committed to fighting COVID-19 by promoting COVID-19 vaccination and making sure that the members of the different organizations understand the benefits and the effectiveness of the COVID-19 vaccine.
Crittenden says Farm Bureau is working at the grassroots level to get the word out about the importance of getting vaccinated.
We are making sure that these farmers and ranchers understand the benefits of the COVID-19 vaccine and have the appropriate tools to handle any sort of issues with vaccine hesitancy or concerns and questions about the vaccine. Through our work in the COVID Community Corps, we have all kinds of messaging available to us that we plan to share with our state farm bureaus and all of our members in order to get the word out about the importance of getting the COVID-19 vaccine.
Deemed essential workers, Crittenden says it is important those in agriculture get the vaccine as soon as possible.
Farm workers and farmers are an essential part of our critical infrastructure. They never had the option to work from home. So it's important that they have access to the vaccine to ensure that they're protected while they are still going to work each day and still farming.
Michael Clements, Washington.
House lawmakers recently introduced the Preserving Family Farms Act of 2021, a priority for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. NCBA has long supported efforts to reduce tax burdens on farmers and ranchers. The bipartisan legislation to expand IRS Code Section 2032A would allow cattle producers to take advantage of the special use valuation and protect family-owned businesses from the impact of the federal estate tax, commonly referred to as the death tax. The Preserving Family Farms Act increases the maximum amount allowed under the exemption from $750,000 to $11 million, indexed for inflation, thus reviving an important tool in the toolbox for farm and ranch families across the U.S., according to NCBA. If enacted, the legislation will provide a permanent solution to an issue that has long plagued cattle producers. While the current 2032A reduction is 55% higher than the value established two decades ago, USDA estimates that cropland values have increased by 223%. This week's storms are not expected to help add to the western snowpack. Stephanie Ho has more.
Storms are expected this week, but their precipitation is not expected to help add liquid to the snowpack in California, the Great Basin, and the Southwest.
In fact, we're seeing some premature melting in that area. It disrupts the water cycle. Some of that snow melting off early can't be properly captured by reservoirs. And so we'll continue to deal with the very serious drought concerns across much of the nation's southwestern quadrant.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Those problems extend out into the High Plains region of West Texas, where it is time to be planting for crops like cotton.
Instead, there's
a lot of concern about the drought that continues to remain very intense across the southern High Plains, especially West Texas. They will need moisture very soon for development, emergence, and establishment of summer crops like corn, cotton, peanuts, and so forth.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Biden administration has made it clear that climate change and environment are top issues for the administration. So what are some ways the Agriculture Department plans to foster climate-smart agriculture and forestry per a recent presidential executive order? Rod Main looks into it.
Earlier this year, President Joe Biden signed an executive order on how the federal government planned to address climate change concerns. That includes how the Agriculture Department would be involved in these efforts. USDA Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and Climate Advisor Robert Boddy offered descriptions during the recent AgriPulse Ag and Food Summit, starting with a recent notice in the Federal Register related to climate-smart agriculture and forestry practices and systems.
Soliciting input from agriculture and forestry and conservation and other stakeholders. We're also going to host a series of webinars, allow a bit more interaction.
The Agriculture Department will also work with the Department of Interior and other federal agencies in establishing
the Civilian Climate Corps, interest in the White House, and looking for ways to involve young people in all types of activities around conservation and climate.
The Deputy Chief of Staff says USDA can play a role in Civilian Climate Corps development through existing programs and resources.
The U.S. Forest Service already has a big commitment to the 21st Century Conservation Service Corps and the Job Corps Centers and other things that bring young people, veterans and others into forestry. We're going to look for ways that we can, other parts of the department, NRCS, are there some things we can do in the research agencies, try and bring more young people in, more diverse communities into these issues.
The presidential executive order also stated the goal of conserving 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030. How might this be accomplished from the USDA perspective?
From USDA's standpoint, I think the broader administration, this for us is really going to be about collaborative conservation, incentive-based, locally-led conservation, working with farmers, working with ranchers, working with forest owners, recognizing the critical role that working lands play in all kinds of things. Obviously, food production and fiber production, but also water quality, wildlife. We have a really deep stewardship ethic across the United States. We want to tap into that, work with those communities, work with those producers to look at ways that we can expand conservation efforts.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news brief for today. Coming up next, an update on the Salt and Sea Plan. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The State Water Resources Control Board held a public workshop and update on its Salt and Sea Management Plan. According to information put out by the state, under the direction of the governor, California state agencies are advancing projects at the Salt and Sea to improve air quality and provide critical environmental habitat for birds along the Pacific Flyway. Flows into the Salt and Sea have declined in recent years, and the result is a shrinking, increasingly saline lake. As the Salt and Sea recedes, previously submerged lake bed is being exposed, creating dust that is of concern to local communities. Wednesday's meeting started with this update from Wade Crowfoot, who was introduced by Board Chair Joaquin Esquivel.
Well, thanks so much, Chair Esquivel, for all of your work and partnership on this topic. I'm Wade Crowfoot, our Natural Resources Secretary, and really glad to be here today to frame up the discussion and the presentation that we'll soon be providing. I want to also acknowledge just how pivotal Kevin Kelly's leadership has been on all things related to the Salt and Sea. His legacy will continue to be felt for decades to come. So first of all, thanks to you and your staff. As you mentioned, you were quite flexible in allowing this hearing to take place later than originally scheduled to ensure that there was adequate time for public comment on our annual report on the Salt and Sea Management Plan. We're really proud that annual report actually has improved in recent years, and we're proud to share it with you all for discussion today, and very glad to enable the amount of time for public comment. So thanks there. We will soon hear a more detailed report from our key leader in the region on our efforts, Arturo Delgado, our Assistant Secretary for the Salt and Sea. And Arturo will walk through our points of progress and our areas of continued improvement in just a moment. But I wanted to, at the very high level, share my perspective as somebody who is actually fairly engaged in our work on the Salton Sea. So first, let me convey how important a priority this is to me personally, as well as to Governor Newsom, who actually had a chance to visit the sea in the last couple of years. I consider this one of my key priorities in this role as secretary, and that is to lead the state's efforts to fulfill our legal responsibility to help stabilize the Salton Sea. And this is an important yet very complex effort. The size and scope of this challenge is unprecedented. We're talking about an inland sea of 260,000 acres and a sea that's had diminished inflow and has created environmental conditions we haven't encountered in our agency before. Our work requires multi-jurisdictional partnerships between local, state, federal government, tribal governments, community-based organizations, just given the varying land ownership around the sea and in the sea, as well as the different statutory responsibilities of all of our agencies. And then lastly, it's complex and urgent because further degradation of the sea will compound existing crises in the region. Very specifically, poor air quality from a variety of sources that impacts public health of residents in Imperial and Riverside County, as well as further out. And in addition to that poor air quality that further degradation would impact, obviously reduced habitat for wildlife that's come to depend on the sea, particularly birds along our Pacific Flyway. As wetlands across California have been lost over the last century, the Salton Sea has played a really pivotal role in providing habitat to those migrating birds. And further diminishment of the sea obviously exacerbates that, that crisis of nature. The enormity of the challenge of the Salton Sea, I think, frankly, was paralyzing to state government for quite a long time. In other words, the size, the complexity, the cost of addressing this issue resulted in agencies not taking action. Thanks to Governor Brown's administration, important work was established to get our arms around this challenge by establishing a Blue Ribbon Task Force that then evolved into the Salton Sea Management Plan that we'll discuss today. Legislative leaders and the governor secured, with the vote of the people, $200 million of general obligation bond funding to start this work, as well as $80 million from the state's general fund. And then lastly, thanks to your leadership at the Water Board is now is ensuring accountability of our work on this project through a stipulated order. So I would say those were all really important sort of early chapters of this work. And we're now in a new phase, which is executing. In other words, implementing and putting in place and working towards the targets in the Salton Sea Management Plan. And as you know, Chair and board members, we have a focus on the next 10 years within the Salton Sea Management Plan, this restoration of habitat and the suppression of dust over the midterm, but then also, as Arturo will identify or talk about, the development of a long-term plan for the future of the sea. I'm glad that we can report today on significant progress over the last year in executing the Salton Sea Management Plan. Most notably, we are now within construction or have started construction on by far the largest project planned for the sea to date, the Species Conservation Habitat Project at the mouth of the New River at the southern portion of the sea. And that's a really notable point of progress. Special thanks to our partners at the Imperial Irrigation District for working with us to actually provide us access to land that it owns to actually get that work done. That's one project, and we're now focused on additional projects while that project advances. I'm really excited that we have sleeves rolled up on helping develop the project in Desert Shores, which is a small community on the west side of the sea that's very focused on getting water back in to its community for a variety of reasons, as well as working with our partners in Riverside County on the important effort to establish a North Lake pilot project, which we hope is the beachhead for a much larger restoration project and dust suppression project at the northern edge of the sea. And as indicated in our report, there are obviously other projects being formed. As we develop those projects, we have been excited to initiate dust suppression measures in the form of surface roughening, which are temporary measures ultimately to be supplanted by permanent measures to suppress dust. So while some of these projects, like Species Conservation Habitat, will actually inundate and ensure inundation or water on portions of the seabed, we're advancing any number of creative solutions to actually suppress dust across the sea, driven by a dust suppression action plan. We, over the last year, have engaged in more public outreach, and I think that is very much a work in progress. Arturo will identify, detail more public meetings that have taken place. Now a consistent information update that's provided to stakeholders, an improved website, which we would mark as progress. And then lastly, the sort of laborious but important work of clearing projects through the permitting process so that every project can actually move along in parallel, and we can get as much of this work done to meet our management plan targets as we need to. But let me be very clear, while we're proud of the progress we've made, more work is needed, and we need to continue to improve our efforts. And given the feedback that we've received this annual report, we are in real time exploring how we deepen public engagement in our work. While we established an engagement committee over the last year that we felt was important, what we realize is that the level of interest and need for engagement is such that while we should continue to provide for engagement for all manner of stakeholders, we need to go deeper on specific focused engagement in a few areas. One is engaging on the scientific basis for what we're doing, particularly as we're putting a monitoring plan in place. Ensuring community understanding and input in the development of our long-range plan, which will really guide the future of the sea beyond this decade. And then very specifically working to more proactively engage community members in our work, so that we can really go out and understand what they would like to see from achievement of this Salton Sea Management Plan. So you'll hear some constructive critiques on our engagement to date, and we take those seriously, and we're focused on continuing to improve the engagement. Likewise, we need to drive further and faster on getting projects on the ground. And as Arturo will talk about, we're building our staff capacity to be able to do that, thanks in large part to funding provided by the legislature, championed by Assemblymember Garcia and Senator Hueso. Moving forward as secretary, I'm personally engaged in some key aspects of this. And over the next year, there are at least three challenges I'll be focused on helping us navigate. The first is continuing to partner with landowners on the sea. The state of California, our agency, only owns about 1% of the land that has formed the historical Salton Sea. So all of this work that we need to do requires our partnership and ultimately achieving some type of collaborative land use agreement with the owners of the sea, which include federal agencies, Reclamation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Army Corps, and also our Imperial Irrigation District and our Torres Martinez tribal government and partner. And so critical in being able to make progress is actually establishing a large scope of agreement for use of these lands. Second is securing the water that we need for these projects. Most of these projects will involve water in some form or the other. And so we need to make sure that as we're investing in these capital projects, we actually have the water to sustain them. And then the last piece is funding. While we have a significant chunk of funding to advance this work, there is not enough funding that has been secured to date to fully realize the Salton Sea Management Plan. And that is well known, and why we're focused on working with our federal partners, quite frankly, to increase federal investment in this effort, given the federal ownership of a portion of the sea, and continuing to work with our state, our champions here in Sacramento to build our resources, not only for the one-time capital needs to build these projects, but the ongoing operations and maintenance to ensure that once our projects to stabilize and restore the sea are in place, they're actually managed to continue to be effective. So it's obviously a significant amount of work left ahead. We take this work on with significant humbleness and appreciation to key partners. I wanted to end by just calling out the leadership and partnership of a handful of leaders and groups that I've had the chance to work personally with. Certainly, as I said, the Imperial Irrigation District, General Manager Martinez, Tina Shields and her team, IID has so many priorities on which to focus, given its broad remit, and they've really been partners navigating the way forward. We have strong working relationships with both Imperial and Riverside counties, thanks to the leadership of Supervisors Kelly and Perez. We're working constructively with the Executive Officer Matt Desert of the Imperial County Pollution Control District, given their important role ensuring improvement of air quality in the region. And then federal partners that have really stepped up, including from the Reclamation Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps Fish and Wildlife Service. And then lastly, the community-based organizations on the ground, environmental groups that have long focused on this, and importantly, entrepreneurs, community members, innovators that are bringing their passion and ideas to how we stabilize and restore the sea.
We have more in the board meeting after this sponsor message. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
We continue now with the State Water Resources Control Board meeting on the Salton Sea Management Plan. Natural Resources Agency Assistant Secretary for Salton Sea Policy, Alturo Delgado, gave an update on planning and implementation. Here are just a few moments of that.
In 2020, our team continued to place a strong focus on community engagement and progress made in spite of the many challenges presented by the pandemic. The engagement committee, consisting of representatives from stakeholder groups, local leaders, government agencies, and tribal governments, held three meetings in 2020 and helped shape the state's public workshops, refined a draft community engagement plan, and worked on a draft committee charter. These activities will gain further momentum in 2021 as the SSMP team adds staff at the sea dedicated to community engagement and communication. The SSMP team hosted six public workshops for both the Dust Suppression Action Plan and Phase 1 10-year plan project description to share information and gather feedback. The team also accepted written comments during a 30-day comment period for each and posted all comments received, both written and verbal, online. The SSMP team continues to use the comprehensive Salt and Sea website to provide information on projects and opportunities to offer input. The state also continues to share news and updates via the e-newsletter that debuted in November 2019. Comité Cívico del Valle, CCV, a community-based organization, is supporting the SSMP to perform community outreach, education, and engagement. In 2020, CCV supported effective outreach for the Dust Suppression Action Plan meetings, supported pre-NEPA meeting outreach and development of educational materials, prepared a NEPA fact sheet, collected a list of regional media outlets to promote meetings and messaging through paid social media ads, developed a joint media advisory for meetings, and use their program's social platform to disseminate the state messages tailored to the community audience. And then finally, they collaborated to create new public service announcements for community engagement for the Salton Sea. And my understanding is that Miguel will speak to provide additional details during that panel discussion. So looking forward to hear more about that.
During the meeting, board member Sean McGuire asked about the feasibility of the plan and funding.
As an engineer, you know, I'm always thinking about critical path and to ensure project success. You know, my background was in consulting. I spent a lot of time thinking about this on the projects I was engaged with. So I can appreciate the complexity here on such a large scale effort that you're responsible for. And we've talked a little bit about land access today. I can appreciate those challenges. But Secretary Crowfoot, in his opening remarks, he mentioned three things. So he mentioned land access, he mentioned securing water that's needed for the projects actually to inundate even the SCH project, and then funding. And you know, as I understand it, funding is largely secured for the SCH project, but you know, I'm thinking about phase one here. So if you could speak a little bit about you know, what you're able to share in terms of you know, water acquisition here or securing that resource, because it is vital to this. And then also the funding element and the gap that might be there from 2023 forward.
Thanks for asking that question. Let me see. So let me start with the water supply. So we've identified now a pipeline of projects through 2023. You know, frankly, we need to start conversations on securing a water supply agreement for those projects starting this year. I think to the extent that we can programmatically try to cover as much as we can under, you know, the least amount of water supply agreements, I think it's going to be beneficial over the long term. But, you know, I think from my perspective, it's just starting those conversations as soon as possible. You know, we're going to be working closely with Riverside County and Salton Sea Authority on moving forward the North Lake Demonstration Project. And they've already started conversations regarding a water supply with Coachella Valley Water District. So I think early and often those conversations need to happen. I don't have specific dates on when they need to occur. I think they just need to occur as soon as possible. I think with respect to the funding, we currently have funding to fund the entire SCH project. I think I laid out roughly kind of what we have funding for in our annual report. We have funding for about, we've set aside about $15 to $20 million for additional habitat and dust suppression work. So I think that's probably gonna get us up to through about 2023 as far as funding availability. We're gonna be proactively securing funding from the federal government. As I mentioned during my presentation, we are including a watershed management plan component as part of our NEPA document. That's going to position us to be able to pursue funding from farm bill funds that are available through NRCS. So that's gonna be a potential funding source. As Secretary Crowfoot mentioned, you know, there might be some additional proposition funding that are going to be upcoming. So I think we're just going to have to be really assertive and aggressive about pursuing both federal and additional state funding opportunities.
Sure. I appreciate that. Do you have a sense of the, and maybe not yet, because you're still sort of envisioning and solidifying the future, let's say the 2024 through 2028 projects. But is there a sense for that need? You know, what is that funding gap?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So my plan was frankly that once we complete this NEPA process, that's going to help inform the kind of the slate of projects that are going to be part of the 10-year plan. I think at that point in time, we're going to be better positioned to kind of come up with a better estimate of what it's going to cost us to implement the 10-year plan. I can share with you that, you know, we have about $345, $350 million available right now. And most of that's already earmarked for the SCH and, you know, the Northlake demonstration project and the project down in Calexico. And then again, another $15 to $20 million for some additional dust suppression habitat projects. You know, I would guesstimate that we probably have about a third of what we need. You know, I think we're gonna need upwards of another $500 to $750 million to fully implement the 10-year plan.
Yeah. Good to keep in mind. There's a long way to go. So it's helpful for me and hopefully for others to hear about, you know, what are these challenges that you're facing and the fact that you're thinking forward, right? That we're thinking, you know, to get here today has taken a lot of work, and the, you know, the land access was a big barrier. Going forward, there could be other challenges that pop up. It could be some of these that we're talking about. It could be something that we haven't anticipated yet. But I'm happy to hear that you're thinking through that, and you know, the NEPA document, other efforts are going to help kind of solidify some of these challenges and how to overcome them. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Yeah, thank you both. You look at the workshops that the board has held, and we've done each one a little different. We've continued to adjust, and I think definitely is the case with the stipulated order actually, I think has, you know, I think we heard, you know, the deadline for the report is actually March 31st. So it's like, you know, itself dated really close to when we're supposed to hold our workshop. And so I think there's ways that, you know, we're just going to continue to just adjust and more importantly, be responsive to what we're hearing from the community when it comes to either the holding of these workshops, how we format them, or even how on the resources side, the program continues to be implemented.
We will continue to watch water issues around the state. If you know of a topic or a person we should highlight, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS marketing team, thanks for listening.